As I mentioned last night, we've been working at this thing for 42 years now, and one of the things that we've discovered is that the differences between us, because of the way we're wired together inwardly or some physical attribute that may be quite different, it has created problems. And we would just like to take a few minutes for you to get to know us a little bit better this morning on some of these differences, and maybe you can, some of you at least, can identify with what we're talking about and maybe can begin to get the idea of what we're driving at last night, and then we're going to continue on with it this morning in this first session. And some of these things are very minor and yet can create significant problems if we don't learn how to deal with them. For instance, I am nearsighted.
And I'm farsighted.
Now, you know, that doesn't sound like a big deal until you're standing in church on Sunday morning trying to sing out of the same hymn book, you know. Where do you put it? Well, we finally resolved that one by both of us have bifocals now. And it makes things a little easier.
I love romantic candlelight dinners.
Well, I do too. But you got to see what you're eating. I shop by using the Consumer's Report, the Yellow Pages, and the telephone.
Oh, but I want to see everything before I buy and compare and smell it and look at it different light. Go all around town before I buy anything.
It's amazing to me. We have a completely different approach to shopping and buying something.
I love to explore old castles.
Listen, you've seen one castle, you've seen them all. I like all of my shirts hung with the hangers in and the shirts facing left.
Can you believe that?
I don't care for fish, no matter how you try to disguise it.
And I like fish fixed any old way, but I don't like peanut butter.
Can you believe that? Somebody not liking peanut butter. I mean, that's the staple of life. My purpose on a driving trip is to get there.
Oh, yes, but I like to see things along the way and do everything as much as possible. So I'll say, let's stop and ride those dune buggies.
And I'll say, well, maybe we can stop and watch for a while. Next time we'll ride the dune buggies. I say, honey, let's skip the wedding reception.
And I say, well, maybe if we stay 2 hours, that will be long enough.
Now that can be a big one.
Yeah, remember that one.
It was in our relationship anyway. I say, if you haven't played a full 18 holes, you really haven't played golf.
And I say, hey, it's just a game.
I like the bottom line stated up front.
And I think, who needs the bottom line? I like bumpy rides, little planes, and roller coasters.
Oh, she's got a cast iron stomach. And I don't. When I'm sick, I like lots of loving, tender care.
When I'm sick, I want to have the shades pulled down, have a totally dark room, and be left alone.
I like my steak medium and my coffee black.
Me too.
I like my music soft and sweet.
Me too.
I like to get up early and get a start on the day.
Me too. Sometimes.
On a trip, I like to do the driving.
And honey, I love to have you.
I'm asleep when I hit the pillow.
And when I'm laying there trying to unwind, I am so glad you don't snore.
When I'm nervous, I get quiet.
And when I'm nervous, I start talking faster and faster.
Yeah. Right. Well, these are just some of the things, the little things that we've discovered over the years that we've had to work at and work our way through and come to agreement and sometimes adjustment and change and negotiation and compromise in order to make these things work for us rather than against us. And in many respects, it's a fun process. I mean, there's been some hard ones that we've had to work through, but most of the time, it's been an interesting time to work our way through that. But the end result has resulted in us becoming best friends. And that's our goal, to really become best friends. This gal right here is the best friend I have on earth, and I know she feels the same way about me. Lois Wise, in a little book entitled Love Poems for the Very Married, makes this statement. She says, someone asked me to name the time our friendship stopped and love began. Oh, my darling, that's the secret. Our friendship never stopped. It just kept growing and growing and growing. And that's what we desire in our relationship, and I know that most of you do too. So Carol is going to speak this morning, continue on this matter of the differences between us and understanding one another, and I know you are going to love this.
Well, I appreciate so much your prayers, and I feel like I know you already. And I'm here to testify to the fact that sometimes when life gives you double blows and triple blows, and it seems like you hit bottom, that it's rock solid there. And he's the rock. Differences. 2 summers ago, Jack and I stepped out on our little back patio, only to discover that during the night, a squirrel had chewed through the stuffing of two over-upholstered chairs back there, and stuffing was littering the back deck. I looked around and I said, oh, this makes me sick. Jack looked around and said, oh, this makes me mad. I thought, now I've got to cart all that furniture in every night before we go to bed. Jack went down to the Humane Society, got a squirrel trap, trapped 5 squirrels before he felt he had the right one, carted them clear out. One of them's up the glen out here someplace running around. Solved our problem. Same situation, 2 distinctly different reactions. It happens all the time. One mother, one daughter said of her mother and father, she said, you know, when my mom looked out the window and saw the streets of the inner city, she saw need. When my dad looked out the same window to the same streets of the inner city, he saw danger. Same situation, different reaction. And it happens all the time. We have to live with these differences, and we have to understand those differences. And we have to do more than understand them. We have to accept them, appreciate them, and use them to make our relationships stronger together than either one of us could be by ourselves. We have to know our personality types and our mate's personality types, the extrovert-introvert differences, the backgrounds, 100,000 idiosyncrasies that we all have, all these wrapped together, and you know that takes a lifetime. It's a lifetime project we're talking about because we're always changing. Now, God gave us 2 eyes with which to see things from a slightly different point of view. If you only have 1 eye, you know, you lose dimension, perspective. You see things flat. But when you have 2 eyes, you see things in the round. I think that is a beautiful picture of marriage. God gave us 2 distinct personalities, and I trust that we are whole people in these personalities. But that as we come together to form a new thing, an entity, a couple, we come together in order to be the kind of couple that can see things in the round, that can understand life better, can understand people better, the 50% of people at least that aren't like you. Because probably you're married to someone that's not like you. Proverbs 24:3-4 says, by wisdom a house is built, and by understanding it is established. And by knowledge the rooms are filled with all precious and pleasant riches. You know, my friends, most of us have not asked for that kind of wisdom, really. I won't embarrass you, but I doubt if we went around this room this morning and I were to ask you this question, how many of you have prayed for that kind of wisdom in the past week? What would you say? See, God is the only one who really understands me, and God is the only one that really understands Jack, and I need his wisdom in order to be able to understand both of the equations, or the 2 things that go into that equation. but to ask for wisdom. You know, James 1:5, it says, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God. Gives to all men liberally, and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him. Boy, I hang on to that. It shall be given him. That's a wonderful promise from God. And so I pray for wisdom to keep on knowing that man that God's given me. And then the other thing I think we need to pray for very, very often is more love. Just more love. God is love. God is the author of love. God can give love, even toward a very unlovable person. And as we ask God for His love, He gives it to us. And I've seen relationships where a husband and wife have said there's no love left anymore. And I've seen God rebuild that when given His chance, when prayed for. Charlie Shedd says, true love has no maximum. And I like that. There's always new vistas ahead for love. So keep praying for more and more love for one another. The Bible describes marriage as two becoming one flesh. We feel this means way more than the physical. It means becoming one in heart, one in goal, one in vision, one in opportunities, one in mind. Really becoming one flesh, one mind and heart as far as being best friends is concerned. I loved what Rocky Balboa said. You know, when his brother-in-law asked him why he was marrying his sister, and he kind of says, I got gaps, she got gaps. Together we got no gaps. Well, that's not strictly true, is it? We got some gaps, but we got less gaps as we come together and form a couple. But we have to understand those things. I love the little illustration from Elizabeth Elliot's Discipline, The Glad Surrender. She says this. A couple I know had been married only a week or two when the wife went out shopping. The husband wondered what he might do for her while she was gone that would please and surprise her and show her how much he loved her. A brilliant plan came to mind. He got down on his hands and knees and scrubbed the kitchen floor. It was a demeaning task, in his opinion, and he felt exceedingly humble while performing it. How amazed Anne would be. He waited in eager anticipation for her return, thinking how blessed it is to give. She drove in the driveway, breezed into the kitchen, set the grocery bags on the counter, and glanced at the floor. Oh, the floor's clean. Thank you, honey, was all she said, and went about putting things away. The man told me he went into a 3-day funk. He was hurt. He was insulted. He was not properly appreciated. And the blessing of giving drained out in an instant because he had not received the kind of thanks he had expected. Anne had no idea what the trouble was. What she did not know was that her husband had never heard of a man's doing such a thing as scrubbing a floor for his wife, especially voluntarily, having thought of it all by himself. What he did not know was that in his wife's family, no woman ever did the job. Her father considered it a man's job and did it as a matter of course. Now, we laugh at a little thing like that, but, oh, friends, isn't that how rifts begin in our relationship? We just misunderstand, and then we don't talk about it, and then we get hurt, and then we build a little scar tissue around that hurt, and soon that scar tissue has gotten so wide and so high that our relationship is broken. Now, to become one flesh, at least two things are required. Three things. First of all, we need God's help. Jack talked about that last night. The things that we're going to be talking about for the rest of this weekend, my friends, are simply not possible, I don't think, unless we have a supernatural God that's empowering us. Because basically, I don't know about you, but I'm a selfish creature. I am. I want things my way, in my time, when I want it. And yet, years ago, I learned that marriage is not a 50-50 proposition. That marriage is 100% zero proposition, with each one of the ones being willing to give that 100%. Now, do you think that's possible? No. That's not possible. not in the human flesh. The only way that's going to be possible with this is with God's help, His indwelling presence in us, and all His teaching through His Word. So we need God's help. Secondly, I need to be a student of me. I need to know me in order to be able to explain me to Jack. And I know that I'm kind of a complicated person sometimes. And sometimes I get in a mood that's frustration, just filled with frustration, or I'm a bit miffed at something. I'm a bit depressed. And of course, the minute that Jack walks in the room, he knows that something's the matter. And so he'll say, "What's the matter, honey?" And I'll say, "Nothing." You don't do that, do you? No, never. "Nothing is wrong" is a phrase that should be stricken from any married couple's vocabulary. Remember that one. And I'm working on it. And sometimes, see, it has been, when I've said nothing, it has been to try to get back at him for whatever I haven't liked what he's done, see. And that's wrong, too. That's very immature. But sometimes it really is because I don't know. I haven't figured myself out yet. Now, that's not fair either. And you know the thing that I found most helpful? Oh, I've taken all the little self-study quizzes and courses and things like that to try to figure out who I am. And I think that's a good idea. But very often, that isn't what has been the most effective help. The most effective help has been just going to that God who made me, the God who made me, and saying, "Help, Lord. I need you. I need you to tell me about me. What's going on inside of me right now? Why am I feeling so frustrated and so angry or so depressed?" And you know, God gives the answer. In the still, small voice, speaks to my heart and gives me insight that I do not have for myself. That's another reason why you can't get it. You can't make it without His help. But thirdly, I need to understand Jack. Ephesians 4:32 says in the Phillips translation, "Be kind to one another. Be understanding. Be as ready to forgive others as God, for Christ's sake, has forgiven you." Three absolutely vital commands for any relationship, but especially the marriage one. Be kind to one another. So often we're the least kind to those we love the most, aren't we? We think we can get away with it. We know they'll forgive us. And so we're unkind. And I often just shudder when I hear mothers talking to their children in supermarkets on this one. Be kind to one another. A little poem goes, "They were single and went walking, and her heart did skip a beat as she stumbled on the sidewalk. He murmured, 'Careful, sweet. Now the wedding bells have rung.'" And when they walk that self-same street, when she stumbles on the sidewalk, he just yells, "Pick up your feet!" You know, it's too true, isn't it? Be kind, it says. And you know, one of the most wonderful things to me about being a Christ one, a Christian, one who has accepted Jesus Christ into my life, and so has the Spirit of Christ dwelling within me, is this one. God will never give me a command that He, by His grace, will not enable me to do. Oh, am I ever glad for that. Otherwise, half of Scripture, or most of Scripture, would be, I can't do that. But see, God says I can through Jesus Christ, who gives me strength. And I'm so grateful, because you're looking at a pretty ugly person, really, as far as the natural person in here. And if it isn't for God, I'm lost to do these things, to be kind. Then it says to be understanding. A man once said, "A long life is barely enough for a man and a woman to understand each other. And to be understood is to love. The man who understands one woman is qualified to understand pretty well everything." And the reverse is true. And you know, when Adam was lonely, God made for him not 10 friends, but one wife. And I'm so glad for that. And then it says, be forgiving. Sometimes this is where we need to start, isn't it? In any relationship, we hurt one another. And often if those are not worked through and forgiven, then what happens is that we do build a little wall around our emotions. And then we're hurt again. And that wall gets thicker and higher and deeper and wider until nothing gets through to our hearts, our emotions, our lives. Now, friends, some of you may be sitting there and you're thinking, that's us. We're not talking anymore about anything that's important. We're not living together. We're existing together. And I hate it. But I can't do anything about it. Well, that's not true. You may not be able to, but my friends, God can. Really. Because see, this says that we are to forgive as much as God, for Christ's sake, has forgiven us. Well, how much has God, for Christ's sake, forgiven us? How much? Everything. For Christ's sake, God has forgiven me everything. And he says, that's the way I'm to forgive. And I say, but I can't. And he said, oh yes, you can. Not for that person's sake, not for that spouse's sake. They probably don't deserve it, but for my sake. And when you do it for my sake, then I'll open up areas that you never dreamed were possible in your relationship of love. So maybe before this conference is over, two of you need to get together and say, you know, there's some things that need to be forgiven. And I want you to know, I need forgiveness. And how can we work on that? Always start with yourself. Don't ever say you. I think you know that one. One man said, when we quarrel, my wife becomes historical. And his friend said, don't you mean hysterical? And he said, no, I mean historical. She brings up everything I ever did. And yet there's a tremendous verse in Proverbs that says, love forgets mistakes. Nagging about them parts the best of friends. But let's get back to understanding. One minister's wife said this, if I could give one piece of advice, and only one, to women everywhere, it would be this. Study your man. Study him as if he were some rare and strange and fascinating animal, which he is. Study his likes and dislikes, his moods and mannerisms, his strengths and weaknesses. Just loving a man is fine, but it's not enough. To live with one successfully, you have to know him. And to know him, you have to study him. Look around you and decide how many of the best marriages you know are ones where a wife, in a deep sense, actually knows her husband better than he knows himself, knows what pleases him, knows what upsets him, knows what makes him laugh or makes him angry, knows when he needs encouragement, knows when he's too charged up about something and needs to be held back, knows, in other words, exactly what makes him tick. Wow. Do you know your husband that well? Do you husbands know your wives that well? This is part of the adventure. Because, as I said, we're always changing. And so, don't think that I'm the same today as I was yesterday. Now, I'm going to describe just four characteristics about Jack and me so that you can begin a process of study. We hope this will be a lifetime study for you all. And we just want to whet your appetite on who you are, who your spouse is. These are not man-women differences, men-women differences. They are just Jack Carroll differences. So if you men find yourself identifying with me, it doesn't mean you're feminine. If you women find yourself identifying with Jack, it doesn't mean you're masculine. It just means you're different than us. Our point is not to try to peg anybody by sex or anything else. Our point is only to help us begin to study where who we are so that we can begin to fit together. And I'll show you about that too. Jack is a very objective person. And I am a very subjective person. To Jack, a fact is a fact is a fact. To me, a fact is, OK, slightly more than a factor, slightly less than a fact, depending on what mood I'm in. Now, because of Jack's factualness, he can take a detached view of things. He can stand back and look at the situation. I hop right into the middle of it every time. Now, the implications of this in our relationship have been very varied and many over the years. Jack will have a group of men in our living room for a meeting, and I'll be fixing them coffee, and all of a sudden these men are disagreeing. I mean, they're really disagreeing. And I'm thinking, ooh, they're about to come to blows. Next minute, laughing, patting each other on the back, best of friends. That is Jack's objectivity. However, I have also learned that should I say those very same things to Jack, he loses his objectivity. And I have to know that. There's always a balance here, isn't there? But this comes in many times in our relationship. Jack will say, the Joneses are busy and can't come tomorrow. And I'll say, I wonder what we did to offend them. See, I take it personally. Now, that's not wrong, friends. It's just different. Remember that. Not wrong, just different. But subjective people have a hard time taking teasing well. There is no way that Jack can walk in the door and say, hi, chubby, that I don't take it personally. He doesn't do that. He learned that one long ago. Jack is very essential-minded. I am very detail-minded. Jack is inclined to focus on the main subject, the most important thing to be considered. I think in detail. I talk that way too, often. And I see all the little minutiae. I'm well aware of everything that's going on around me. I spent hours and days crying over this one. Jack used to go to week-long conferences, and at that time we had a small daughter, so I stayed home with our daughter, the dog, the washing machine, dial a prayer, you know how it goes. And so he came home and I'd greet him with a big hug and a kiss and I'd say, honey, tell me all about that conference. And he would tell me all about that conference in 10 minutes less. And I would think, oh, he doesn't care enough to tell me about that conference. And if he doesn't care enough to tell me about that conference, then he must not love me the way I long to be loved. My mind always gets back to that somehow. He just must not love me the way I long to be loved. Part of that subjective nature. On the other hand, I would start to tell him about the neighbor down the street. You know, she's the one whose husband was going to run for Senate, and then he decided not to. He decided he'd go into business for himself. And remember, she wears her hair up, kind of twirl like this, but sometimes with a comb through here. And about this time, I look at my husband, and his eyes are glazed and kind of crossed. And I think, he's not listening. And I'm right. And I think, if he's not listening, then he must not be interested in what I'm interested in. And if he's not interested in what I'm interested in, then he must not love me the way I long to be loved. Now, friends, I mean it. I have spent hours and hours crying about this one, simply because I didn't understand my husband. You see, when Jack came back from that conference and told me all about that conference in 10 minutes flat, had he told me all about that conference? In his way, he had told me all about that conference. Why? He'd zeroed in on the essential things, the most important things to be considered. I wanted to hear the details. And so I didn't think he was telling me about the conference. Now, he has learned through the years to keep track of those really little important things that I want to hear about. You know, who's going to have a baby and who got engaged and the best meal he had and some of those things. Really important things to me. On the other hand, I want you to know that I have learned how to boil a juicy 4-hour story down to 10 minutes flat. But the flip side of that coin is that Jack knows that there are times when I have just got to get it all out. And he's trained himself to listen. You know what this does, friends? This means that Jack relates to the 50% of the world that are detail-minded or more. And he's patient, a lot more patient than he used to be, with co-workers that are detailed. Find it. And he's had some that he said, drive me right up the wall because of all the details they got to get out. But see, now he understands. Fit together. Now, essential-minded people, of course, go right to the heart of it. Jack will say, that's a good-looking car, but how does it run? That's the essential. And I'll say, I just don't like the color. That's the detail. Jack will say, I like that speaker's ideas. And I'll say, did you know that notice that his shirt matched his tie? Now, I'm exaggerating, but not a whole lot. It wasn't that I didn't notice the speaker's ideas. I did. It was that I noticed something else, too. Not wrong, just different. Thirdly, Jack is a very logical person, and I am a very emotional person. Jack is inclined to study the evidence and in a step-by-step reasoning process reach a conclusion. I rely on my intuition, my instinct, my feelings to reach the conclusion. Many times, the same conclusion. And my way's faster. Got that last night, didn't you? I'm the fast one. Okay. Now, someone has suggested that a person who is the detail person is also this intuitive person or maybe a more emotional person. Let me show you how that works. Being both the detail-minded person helps me in this intuitive kind of person. Because someone suggested that actually intuition is simply a mind for details. We pick up a host of details that other people lots of times don't pick up. Jack and I can go into a situation and we see entirely different things. I am aware of that tone of voice, that raised eyebrow, that body posture. 20 little details that get filtered into my mind come out a feeling, if you will, an intuition. Jack sees different things. So when we come away from, say, a counseling situation or another type of situation, Jack will ask the question, honey, how did you feel about that situation? That's the key question because I can't tell him all these little things I saw. So I tell him how I felt about that. He filters that through his very objective grid. We can go back into that situation, ask some other questions, and come out, you see, with a much better picture together than either one of us could by ourselves. We come out with that picture in the round. Isn't that great? That's just one way that you can take these characteristics which can drive you up a wall if you don't really understand them and appreciate them and fit them together for God's glory and for your helpfulness to other people. Now, Jack is we're still learning on this one, let me tell you. Logical people, let me say this first, logical people think in a straight line like that, and emotional people think all around and talk all around the topic. And of course, this absolutely drives logical people straight up sometimes. And for instance, before we're to go out for dinner, I'll say, I suppose I ought to go change. And Jack will say, well, why don't you? And I'll say, well, don't you like what I've got on? And he'll say, well, it's okay, but you said you were going to change. And I'll just say, I said, well, I was just saying that to see if it was okay not to. Isn't that awful? Yes, it is awful. I know it's awful, and God's working on me. And one of the cardinal rules of communication is to say what you mean and mean what you say. And we'll be talking about that some later. But Jack realizes that I'm never going to quite get there. Because of this personality, I do creep up on things, and you see, I do it almost deliberately because I'm so afraid that I might hurt you or that you might hurt me back. And so instead of just saying, well, even the example is I used to go out and buy a dress, and I'd come home and I'd say, how do you like it? And Jack would say, I like it. Well, I'd take it back. Because, see, I didn't believe him. He wasn't getting enough emotion into his voice. He was just making a flat statement. Now I know if he says, I like it, he likes it, it's okay. But I have to learn about this thing. Now we are still learning on these. This practical kind of person, one temperament type indicator, calls a sensing individual. Some of you that are familiar with the Myers-Briggs, this will be familiar to you. But the sensing type individual takes in information through their five senses, what they see, hear, smell, touch, taste. And that's a very practical way to take in information. As opposed to the intuitive type person who takes in information from a sixth sense. Maybe all those wish together, but we ski jump in our thinking, an intuitive type person. An intuitive type person is liable to be a very imaginative type person. I am convinced, my friends, that all of the time management books are written by this five-sensing individual, this very practical, logical individual. That all of the communication, and by the way, 70% of people are this, and that is not a made-up statistic. You got to watch me with my statistics, but that, I didn't make that one up. 70% of people test out as being this sensing kind of logical person. 30% test out as being this intuitive type person. Okay. I'm convinced that all of the communication books are written by this intuitive type person. My friends, Jack and I have been married for 42 years, and I just discovered this about 5 months ago, an application to this. We'd known this basic thing. But you see, on our dates, I would always save up these what I considered to be really great questions to ask Jack. What I considered to be fun type questions. And this was going to generate this wonderful conversation that we were going to have at our date, see. So we would go on a date and I'd say, honey, if you were to rent a billboard for 2 months, what would you put up on it? Jack would say, really haven't thought about that. Okay. Another time, another place. What kind of animal would you be if you could be any animal? Really haven't thought about that. Another time, another place. If you had $1 million, what would you spend it on? Really haven't thought about it. Well, you get the idea. I couldn't. Now, let me say in his defense that there have been times when he has really tried hard to enter into my off-the-wall questions, but sometimes not with great enthusiasm. A few months ago, he had arthroscopic surgery on his shoulder. And while he's having arthroscopic shoulder surgery, I am reading a book on what you should know as a widow. And I realized there were some things that I didn't know. And so 2 weeks later, we're out for a date. And I said, honey, who do you want to have preach at your memorial service? And he said, I really don't know. And I said, well, what songs do you want sung at your memorial service? He said, you know, I really don't care. I'm not going to be there. But see, that was a question I really wanted to know. I mean, to me, that was not a theoretical question. Okay, it was not an off-the-wall question. I really wanted to know. So I went back to the drawing boards and I thought, all right, now how do I ask a practical question to a practical person, the same question, but get it so he can hear it. It's part of knowing your mate, okay? So the next time we went out, I said, honey, one of us is going to die before the other. And if you happen to die first, there's some things that in the moment I am not going to be able to make a decision about, and I really need to know. Who do you want to preach at your memorial service? And he gave me 3 names. But my friends, we're learning, aren't we? We've got to learn about who we are and keep on making applications, which are many and varied. Lastly, Jack uses speech to convey facts and ideas. I use speech often. It goes right back to that to express feelings and emotions. We're looking at an absolutely gorgeous moon, like 2 nights ago. Did you see the moon 2 nights ago? And I say, oh, isn't that a gorgeous moon? And Jack says, yes, that's bright enough to shoot a golf ball by. He actually did say that one time, but he smiled. He knew what I was saying. Because what was I saying? Well, see, I was expressing a feeling, wasn't it? I was saying, oh, that moon makes me feel romantic. I look outside and I say, oh, it's raining outside. Well, what am I saying? I'd be saying a lot of things. I could be saying, oh, it's raining outside. That makes me feel so energetic. I'm going to clean house like crazy. Or I could be saying, oh, that makes me feel depressed. I don't like it to rain. But chances are I'm expressing a feeling. Jack looks outside. He says, it's raining outside. Well, what is he saying? The heavens have parted and little drops of moisture are falling to the ground. He is expressing a fact. I am expressing a feeling. Very important one to understand, my friends. Just after I was studying this one about Jack, I backed the car out a little too fast. Here we go again, fast. And I took a little piece of the garage with the back fender back there. I came in and said, oh, I feel terrible. You just can't imagine what it was like. That car went crutch. And Jack stopped me just like that. He said, never mind that. What happened? Oh. My first thought was, he doesn't care. And if he doesn't care about my feelings, then he must not love me the way I long to be loved. Friends, if that had happened even 6 months before it did, I would have gone through the whole day, teary on the inside, pouting on the outside probably, and until we'd finally worked that through. And we never really did work it through. We'd get it settled, but we would never understand because we didn't understand the principle involved in it. But my second thought was, no, that's not true. He does care. He does love me. He will listen to my feelings. He's just got to have the facts first, and that's okay. So I told him the facts, and then he listened to my feelings. Where are you? Are you beginning to get the idea? There's a lot of help out there now. There wasn't when Jack and I started to study this. In fact, I read a while ago now a little book called Passive Men, Wild Women. Secular little book. Good little book. And the author's theory is, and he does put this into a man-woman category. He's a counselor. He works all the time with people who are on the verge of a divorce in the business world. He says that women are made up so that even though they have been out in the job market and they come home, or whether they've been with 10 little kids, whatever the situation is, that they're made up, most of them, to when the husband comes home from work, they want to drop in to that relationship. They want intimacy. They want talk. They want to come together in a close relationship. A man, after he's been in the marketplace, he comes home, he wants to drop out. He wants distance. And he's saying this is pretty universal. And so we've got the woman here who wants a close relationship and to drop in. We've got a man here who wants to drop out. And so he backs off and she presses. And he backs off and she presses. And that's why he's called his book Passive Men, Wild Women. Because the women get wilder desiring this relationship. Well, now, do you know that? Is that true of your relationship? Is that something you need to talk about? And solutions? Does your husband need a half hour of quiet before he drops in? Can you compromise on that? He says more divorces are caused from this one thing than any other one thing that he runs into. The fallout for that. One other thing that we hear a lot about today, and I want to just mention, and that is, many psychologists are telling us today that one of your primary jobs, as early in the marriage as you are right now at least, is to find out the primary way your spouse expresses love. The primary love language of your spouse, and then your own. Psychologists give us 5. Jack and I have added 2. And the first one is just words. Some of us have got to hear the words, not just the I love you words, but the encouraging words, the hey, that's great. Terrific meal, hon, thanks. The just the building up type of words. If we don't hear the words, we do not feel loved. We'll see that. Second is touch. Some of us are touchers. We need to be touched. We touch as an expression of our caring and our love. And so we do not feel loved if we are not touched. We are not held. Third is time. Not time just spent in front of the television tube, but time in in-depth communication. Time of heart touching, I call it. Doesn't have to be lengthy times, but just frequent times of heart touching time. Fourth is gifts. Some people are gift givers, and you may have one in your circle, and they're always remembering to bring you some little thing that you had mentioned sometime. And that is their way of showing love. And by the way, friends, let me say this. If you have a friend like that, or if your spouse is like that, remember that they are likely to hear love in a way that they give love. So if you have a gift giver in your circle, try to remember to give them little gifts too, because that's the way they'll hear it best. Five is deeds. Doing things. Now this can be providing well. I mean, some husbands will work their heads off to provide well for their wives, and their wives don't even hear that this is a language of love because they want the time, and he's not giving them the time. And so they're not even saying thanks for the big way that he's giving love. And you see, our objective here is not only to discover the primary language of love, but to start building secondary languages of love as well, so that you really develop an overall wonderful, in-depth form of communicating love to one another. Jack is a caregiver. He falls into this category as far as giving love. It's one of his love languages. And I feel sort of like Elizabeth Elliot did when she dedicated her book on asking God why this way. She said, "To my husband Lars Gren, who builds the fences around me and stands on all sides." And I like that, because that's funny. Jack stands, he builds fences around me, not to keep me in, but to protect me. And then he stands on all sides in that protecting. And I just love him for it. So deeds. Jack and I have added two. You won't find these anyplace else. But Jack hears my love primarily through my loyalty to him. Jack feels my love when it's Jack and me against the world. Whenever he says, "Honey, are you really with me in this?" then I know I have not communicated to him my love and my loyalty. And that speaks volumes to him. I hear his love primarily through his acceptance of me. I'm kind of a nut, and I know it. And, and you know, I have these far-out questions and far-out ideas sometimes. But to my knowledge, I can never remember Jack saying, "Honey, that's got to be the stupidest idea you ever came up with." Never has. May have thought it, but he's never said it. And as a result, I feel loved. I feel accepted. It's given him, he's freed me to be me, for one thing. He's been given the advantage of that one idea out of 100 that might be worth something. But then more than that, he's demonstrated his love in a way that I really, really hear it. I'm just going to finish with Romans 15, 5 to 7, and I've changed it slightly from the NIV. It says this, "May the God who gives endurance and encouragement give you a spirit of unity as a couple, as you follow Christ Jesus, so that with one heart and mouth you may glorify the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Accept one another then, just as Christ accepted you, in order to bring praise to God."
The scripture talks about this, and there's a fascinating passage found over in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, the last half of that chapter, that in an indirect way deals with this whole issue that we're talking about. If you have your Bibles, you might want to turn to that, 1 Corinthians chapter 12, beginning with verse 14. Now, this passage is talking about the body of Christ. And what it does is it compares the body of Christ, which is a spiritual thing, which those of us who know Jesus Christ personally as our Savior, we're a part of that. And it's a worldwide thing. But it's comparing that to our physical body and the parts of it and the different functions of the parts and the fact that the different parts need each other. Well, I was reading this passage some time ago, and it dawned on me that this could be talking about marriage. I mean, it isn't the passage on marriage, but it's got application to us in terms of this matter of why we are different and how we are to make that function and what God's goal is for it. So I'd like to read it to you and make a couple of comments as we go along, beginning with verse 14. It says, "Now the body is not made up of one part, but of many. If the foot should say, 'Because I'm not a hand, I do not belong to the body,' it would not for that reason cease to be a part of the body. And if the ear should say, 'Because I'm not an eye, I do not belong to the body,' it would not for that reason cease to be a part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would the sense of hearing be? If the whole body were an ear, where would the sense of smell be?" You're beginning to get the idea here. In other words, we are different than each other. But the next statement is very significant. Verse 18. "But in fact, God has arranged the parts in the body, every one of them, just as He wanted them to be. It is not accidental from God's perspective that I am married to Carol, who is so significantly different than I am. It is not accidental from God's perspective that you are married to someone who may be quite different in many ways than you are. And so we need to recognize that, take it into consideration, and also it helps me anyway to recognize the fact, hey, that's the way God planned it. He caused us to meet at Wheaton College years and years ago and fall in love and then out of love and in love and out. We broke our engagement 3 times. Our friends thought we'd never make it. But eventually we did. I gave her the ring back the 3rd time and that sealed it. And then we got married. That was not accidental. That was part of God's plan. And down through the years, He had some purposes in that. Well, then He goes on. God has arranged the parts in the body, every one of them, just as He wanted them to be. Great diversity. That's what He's talking about here. Great diversity can exist between us as a husband and a wife. If they were all one part, where would the body be? And as it is, there are many parts, but one body. Now, in verse 21, he sort of shifts gears. And instead of talking about the diversity, he begins to talk about the fact that we need each other because of this diversity. The eye cannot say to the hand, "I don't need you." The head can't say to the feet, "I don't need you." On the contrary, those parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. And the parts that we think are less honorable, we treat with special honor. And the parts that are unpresentable, we treat with special modesty, while our presentable parts need no special treatment. But God has combined the members of the body and has given greater honor to the parts that lack it. See, God has done this. This is His doing. So that, now this is what God's goal is, so that there should be no division in the body. In other words, these differences are not to divide us. They are to unite us. But we know that that takes working at, doesn't it? Huh? But that's God's goal. So that there should be no great diversity, but no division. But that its parts should have equal concern for each other. If one part suffers, every part suffers with it. If one part is honored, every part rejoices with it. Man, when I see Carol laying there on that bed and that kidney stone is flared up, I know it's hurting her, but it hurts me too. Huh? And that's the way we are, isn't it? When one part suffers, we suffer with it. And when one part is honored, we're honored with it. Yeah. So that's God's will. No great diversity, but no division. And this thing creeps up in so many little tiny ways. Carol came across an article in Red Book magazine some time ago. Red Book is not one of my favorite magazines, but she reads it from time to time. And this guy was, I think he was a psychologist. He was talking about family backgrounds and the fact that sometimes when two people enter into marriage, they come into it with the idea that they're going to both be operating as actors would on a stage from the same script. And probably nothing could be further from the truth. We come into this thing called marriage from different kinds of backgrounds, and it would be very unusual that we would be thinking same script type of thing. And then he goes on to give a little illustration, a rather homey thing, about his own days of early in their marriage. And he says, in the early days of my own marriage, I would have sworn that my wife and I had discussed every aspect of life and love. We'd known each other from kindergarten. That goes way back. Dated from the 10th grade and had been engaged for a year and a half. That is, before they got married. But we never discussed what happens when you're sick. And if someone had suggested that we discuss it, I would probably have laughed at them. Every right-thinking person knows what you should do when you get sick. You go to bed. That's your part. Then your mother or whoever loves you pumps you full of fruit juice. Well, I married this woman I'd known all my life, and in the natural course of events, I caught the flu. I knew what to do, of course. I went to bed and waited. But nothing happened. Absolutely nothing. I couldn't believe it. I was so hurt I would have left if I hadn't been so ill. Finally, I asked about juice, and she brought me some in a little 4-ounce glass, period. Now listen to this. Because as I learned later, he didn't know this beforehand. As I learned later, the only time they drank juice at her house was on alternate Tuesdays when they graced breakfast in a thimble-sized glass. My family's juice glasses held 12 ounces, and there was always someone standing around to refill them when they were empty. Now, what a dumb little thing, huh? And yet, that is what married life is often made up of, isn't it? These little things that happen that we just don't understand. Our daughter and her husband, Tim, they got married. And Lynn has always had a little bit of a stomach problem. She gets butterflies in her stomach quite easily and gets upset. Tim, on the other hand, has headaches from time to time. Well, when Lynn has a headache, she really doesn't pay too much attention to it. She'll take a couple aspirin and go about her business. But when she has a stomachache, she's sick. Tim, on the other hand, when he has a little stomachache, he goes about his business, doesn't pay any attention to it. But when he's got a headache, that really gets to him. Well, they went through the first several years of their marriage having absolutely no sympathy for one another because of just the way their attitude was toward headaches and stomachaches. The difference. Until one day it dawned on them that what Tim had to do was when Lynn got a stomachache, he had to think headache. And when Tim had a headache, she had to think stomachache. And then the empathy began to flow between the two of them. Well, you know, just a little thing like that. 12-ounce juice glasses. It's no big deal. But Carol and I came across stuff like that in the early days of our marriage. For instance, one of the first things, that we ran into, and it came primarily because of the way our families had practiced this. Carol came from a family that was comprised of a bunch of huggers and kissers. The way that they showed affection and appreciation and so forth and concern for one another was a hug and a kiss. My family, just the opposite. There was very little hugging and kissing. There was never any doubt in my mind that my parents loved me. It was just shown in different ways. Well, then we got married. And, you know, I'd come in from work at night, walk in the back door, and there she'd be warmly to greet me. She'd throw her arms around me, give me a hug and a kiss. And I just didn't know how to respond to that. It was kind of a new experience. And so I sort of stood there like a telephone pole. It was just, well, okay, let's get this over with, That had gone on for a few weeks, and then Christmas rolled around, and we went up to her place, her home, for Christmas. And her mom and dad were going to be there, her older brother, younger sister, an aunt and an uncle, and a couple of cousins. And we'd gone together to get them all Christmas presents. And so it got to be opening Christmas present time, and her brother, her older brother, was opening his present. He was sitting across the room from us, and he, ripped the paper off and opened the box and made this giant exclamation about how great this was. And then he jumped up out of his seat, came roaring across the room, grabbed Carol, pulled her up out of her seat, gave her a great big hug and a kiss. Ness, guess who was next in line? Oh, man. I died 1,000 deaths that Christmas because it was not only her brother, it was his cousin, it was her dad. And pure agony. Well, time went by, and she was still there warmly greeting me at the back door. And the bedroom, now that was another thing. That's a whole different world than this kind of spontaneous outward show of affection, a greeting at the door. And I was still pretty stiff and totem pole type approach to this, and I could tell that Carol was getting a little miffed at it. And I knew that something had to change, and so we sat down one night and talked about it. We've discovered that talking about things like this often leads you to solutions. So we sat down and we talked about it. Well, in the course of talking about it, she says, "Well, honey, do you want me to stop?" Well, I'd already thought about that. I had gotten to the place where I really liked it. I didn't want her to stop. I just didn't know how to respond. It was something that was not in my background. It was such a strange new phenomenon to me, this spontaneous showing of affection and hugging and kissing. It was just not in my vocabulary, I guess. Well, we continued to talk, and as a result of that conversation, I decided that I was going to learn how to do this. If it killed me, I was going to learn how to do it. And so Carol became my hugging and kissing coach. So I'd walk in the door at night, and she'd be there, throw her arms around me. I'd be there like this. She'd say, and then she'd say, "Now, honey, relax." So, I'd kind of relax a little bit. "Now put your arms around me." So, I'd kind of get my arms around her. "Now squeeze a little bit." So I'd squeeze. Well, after a while, a little practice and coaching and encouragement from her, I began to loosen up and began to feel a little comfortable with this. And now after 42 years, I can hug and kiss with the best of them. Now, in that situation, somebody had to change. Something had to give in order for us to work through that in such a way that we could both accept it, live with it, be happy with it. And I decided I needed to go Carol's way. And as I think back on it, folks, I am so glad I went Carol's way. We have found ourselves in numerous situations over the years where if I had not learned how to naturally hug and give a little peck on the cheek, it would have been embarrassing at times. It would have sort of closed doors for us at times. We were in France one time. Good night. And we were in this home, and this young couple that we were, who were the host and hostess, they had invited about 10 of their friends, couples, over for the evening to share with, for us to share with them and just interact with them on the subject of marriage. Well, when they all, as each of them arrived, it was a hug and a kiss on both cheeks. That, I had to stand back and kind of watch that, see how they did that before I tried it. And then the same thing in reverse when they left. I mean, it took us 45 minutes just to say goodbye to those people because of all this hugging and kissing that went on. But, you know, I look back on it, man, I'm glad that I went Carol's way. And there have been many other situations where it's just been of such practical help. So, you know, where are you? In this matter of being willing to change, make adjustments, compromise, work your way through a situation, negotiate, figure out what you're going to do to make this thing work for you rather than against you. From time to time, I hate to say it, but I run into husbands, and I suppose there are wives like this too, but mostly I run into husbands, who they may not say it, but their attitude is, look, she knew what I was like when she married me. She can learn to live with it. What a terrible way to go through life. Can you imagine being the same at 65 as you were at 20? With the same set of prejudices, no changes, still locked into your old ways of doing things, no progress, no growth, no maturity, no change. Change is the name of the game in marriage. We've got to learn to do that. Another thing that Carol and I ran into shortly after we got married was this business of introvert-extrovert. And I'm sure that some of you have faced that. It's never something that has been a problem between us. Carol is the extrovert, I'm the introvert. And I have always appreciated Carol's outgoing, bubbly, talkative personality because it makes up for so much of what I lack. And I have learned to capitalize on that over the years. But I know that it can be a problem. We had a young couple come through town one time and visited us. And they stayed overnight a couple nights, and he and I were sitting having an extra cup of coffee after breakfast. The gals had gone off shopping or something. And we were sitting there talking, and he got quite serious all of a sudden. He said, Jack, could I ask you a personal question? And I said, sure. And he says, well, I've noticed that your wife, Carol, and my wife, Pat, are quite a bit alike. And then he described this outgoing, talkative, bubbly, effervescent type of personality. And he was right. They were very much alike, and I agreed with that. He says, and then I've noticed that you and I are quite a bit alike. And he described more reserved, not as talkative, not always knowing how to respond in a crowd, and not exactly a wallflower, but, you know, not that outgoing type of thing. And I agreed with him. We were pretty much alike. But here was his question. How do you handle that problem? Underline the word problem. And as we continued to talk, what I discovered was that he at times was threatened and even intimidated at times by this wonderful personality that his wife had. Because he wasn't that way. He was different than she was. And she seemed to, you know, go with the flow and be able to mix with the crowd. And he always felt sort of reserved. And so as we continued to talk about that, I told him, hey, man, you've got a terrific wife. She's got a wonderful personality. What you need to learn to do is capitalize on it. Make it work for you rather than become a threat to you. I said, for instance, I hate small talk. That may be, you know, a slight overstatement. I immensely dislike it. Probably, you know, I don't know whether there's much difference there. But anyway, you're with a group of people and, you know, the conversation has kind of deteriorated to last week's football game and your golf game and the weather and that type of thing. That to me is small talk. And we'll be standing around three or four couples talking, and after about 10 or 11 minutes of that, mentally, I just tune out. I go back to the office, and I begin to work on some project I'm working on, or some decision I'm facing, or some personnel matter that I'm struggling with. Now, I keep a very intelligent look on my face. Nobody Nobody knows that I'm not there except Carol. She knows. She sees some twinkle in my eye or something that she knows. And so what she does is she picks up on the conversation and says, enough for both of us, so that they don't even miss me. Now, I don't know how you view that, but I view that as an asset. I mean, that is a terrific asset. Of course, eventually somebody asked me a question, and I don't even hear it because I'm not there mentally. But she knows that I'm not there, and so she says, honey, and that brings me to, she'll repeat the question, I give an answer, it doesn't matter what I say, there's small talk anyway, and they go on to their conversation, and I go back to work. Now that to me is a terrific asset in her wonderful personality to compensate for some of the things that I lack. Well, as I was telling this guy about it, he began to get the picture. And we've stayed in touch with him over the years. And he has his whole attitude toward his wife's personality has changed. And he not only respects it, he's learned to capitalize on it. And use it to make up for some of the things that he lacks. And of course, he makes a significant contribution because he's the steady one. He's the guy who keeps the boat from rocking too much. And so his contribution with his personality is that. So we all have a contribution to make. Well, let me just wrap this up with one story, and then we'll go to coffee break. A number of years ago, Carol and I were coming back from 2 weeks down in Florida. We'd been down there on business. It was not a vacation. We were deeply involved with people's lives. We had a couple of seminars. I had some business meeting with some of our staff people. And it was 2 weeks of go, 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 go. And we were tired, ready to get home and get a good night's sleep in our own bed. So we flew from Orlando to Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, and then we were going to catch another flight out of there home to Colorado Springs. Well, as we were coming into land at the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, the pilot came on the intercom and said, folks, the weather down there is really bad. The Dallas-Fort Worth area has experienced one of the worst storms in years, and it's icy, it's cold, it's really miserable. Well, we landed. You could kind of tell the plane skidded on the icy runway. Then we got off the plane, walked into the terminal, and man, he was right. I mean, nothing was working. The heat was not on. The clocks were not working. They had auxiliary lights, you know, the battery backup on the lights. And if you've ever been to Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, you know it's a huge place, and you get from one terminal to another on these little electric trains. Well, of course, the electricity was off. The trains weren't running. We were already about 2 hours late, tired, worn out, frustrated by this out-of-control situation, anxious to get home. It was about 10 or 10:30 at night. And so we found ourselves in that condition, standing outside in the cold at the curb, waiting for a bus to come and pick us up and take us to the terminal where we needed to get to in order to catch our flight home to Colorado Springs. Well, I was standing there, hands in my pockets, kind of looking down at the ground, minding my own business, not saying anything, not bothering anybody. Carol was standing next to me, and next to her was a little old lady who was very concerned as to whether she was going to make it home that night and get to sleep in her own bed. And so Carol began to cheer her up. Don't worry, honey. The bus will be here pretty soon. All the planes are running late anyway. Your plane will be there waiting for her. You'll get home tonight. On and on. Yak, 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 she went. Well, pretty soon this yakking over here began to penetrate my thinking, and it began to bother me a little bit. And so I pulled my hand out of my pocket, and I doubled up my fist, and I just nudged her on the thigh. That meant in nonverbal communication, shut up. And she got the message. She didn't speak to me hardly the rest of the way home. Well, within 10 seconds after I had done that, probably shorter, I realized that I'd made a terrible mistake. And so I began to try and apologize. And nothing seemed to work. Finally, the bus came. We got on. I put my arm around her, gave her a little squeeze, and said, honey, I'm sorry. Will you forgive me? I wasn't thinking about you. I was thinking about me. And she kind of grunted. And then we got on the airplane, and two or three more times I apologized, and finally, before we got home, she had forgiven me, and there was harmony and peace between us. Now, let me just put a parenthetical thought in here. Sometimes after I have told this story, people come up to me and they say, well, why was Carol so hard on you? Why was she so hard to forgive? Why was it so hard and difficult for her to forgive? You remember the languages of love she just shared with you up here? How does she hear my love? Through my acceptance of her. She is a nut. I love her for it. She adds spark and zest and zing to our relationship that I would never be able to put there. It's all simply because of the way she's wired together. But see, it's my acceptance of her. And what was the nudge on the thigh? Lack of acceptance, wasn't it? For her way of doing things. And that's why it really got to her. I didn't realize that at the time until later, much later, I found that out. But anyway, we got home, went to bed, put our heads on the pillow, at peace with each other. The scripture says, don't let the sun go down on your wrath. And we have tried to make that a practice of our marriage relationship, to not let anything be still between us that is unsettled, or at least we know where we're going to head with it before we turn the light on and go to bed at night. Now, I have to admit that sometimes the sun is set very late, like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, before we get something resolved. Not so much anymore, but in the earlier days, that was true. Now, most couples that we run into, and we talk to about some dispute or conflict that they've had with each other, and then they get it settled, and man, there's such a relief, and there's peace and tranquility once more. And the last thing in the world they want to do is go back and talk about that problem that was generated between them, the conflict and what happened. Man, that's past history. Let's get on with the rest of life. That is the way most of us handle those kind of situations. We make up, kiss, go to bed, and then the next day we press on with the rest of life. Listen, folks, if we do that, we are passing up one of the greatest opportunities life affords us to really get to know each other, to understand one another. What makes the other person really tick? And so the next day, after we'd had a good night's sleep, we sat down and we talked about the Dallas-Fort Worth airport thing. What had happened there? Why was our response to the same set of circumstances, both of us feeling almost identically the same way about the circumstances, but why was our response so different? My standing there, hands in pockets, not saying a word, Carol standing over here, yakking up a storm. Well, we began to talk about it. I began to tell Carol what was going on in my mind. I said, I was trying to solve this problem we had. I was having an imaginary conversation with the airport manager. And he and I were trying to figure out how to get the planes back on schedule, how to get the lights back on, the electricity on, the trains running, the clocks running again, get the heat on. See, I'm a problem solver by nature. My daughter has often told me, Dad, if you didn't have a problem to solve, you would find one. And, you know, she's right. I had found a doozy here. This was really a honey, and I was working on it with the airport manager, and he and I were, you know, talking about this. And well, when I'm doing that type of thing, I don't like outside interference. You know, all this yakking going on over here, and that's kind of what bothered me. Well, Carol began to explain to me what was going on with her. And the way that Carol primarily copes with that kind of a situation, where she's tired, worn out, it's out of control, she can't quite get a handle on it, it's frustrating, is by what she would describe as forced cheerfulness. In other words, inwardly, she forces herself to be cheerful about a very uncheerful situation. And one of the things that helps her cope with that and be cheerful is to help cheer somebody else up. And so this little old lady here was her victim. Well, you know, we've probably talked about that for a half hour, 45 minutes, until we got everything out and explained what was going on. But you know, it gave us a far greater understanding of each other and how we worked, how our minds worked, how we coped. We'd never understood that about each other before. Well, right near the end of that conversation, Carol said, "Well, honey, next time that happens, what do you want me to do?" Ooh. Boy, listen, guys, when your wife asks you that kind of question, man, you better give some thought to it, because you're going to have to live with the answer the rest of your life. And so I thought about it, and I was honest. I said, "Honey, I want you to be yourself." I get that. But see, now I understood. And I knew that that would make a difference. And sure enough, about 3 months later, we found ourselves in a similar situation. I don't remember all the details of it, but we were standing there, I had my hands in my pocket, she was standing next to me. We were tired, we were frustrated, it was an out-of-control situation, and next to her was a little 12-year-old boy who was lost. And she began to cheer him up. "Don't worry, we'll find your parents, we'll get this all straightened out," yak, you know. And pretty soon I began to hear all this over here. But now I knew what was going on, and that made all the difference in the world. And I didn't say it outwardly, but inwardly I just thought to myself, "Sick of money, you know, have at it." And I went on about solving this problem that I had. Now let me ask you a question. Putting the fist on the thigh aside, that was wrong. I had to apologize for that. I had to get forgiveness for that. But putting that aside, whose way of coping with that situation there, standing in the cold at the curb at the Dallas-Fort Worth airport, whose way was right and whose way was wrong? It's not a matter of right and wrong, is it? It's just different. See, we got to get that into our heads. It's not wrong most of the time. It's not wrong. It's just different. But then we got to take the next step and find out what that difference is and what makes our spouse tick so differently than we do. And that brings us to greater understanding of one another and causes these differences to come together and become assets in our relationship rather than liabilities. Okay? Good. 5 minutes late, let's go to coffee.